From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the criminal justice reform battle in Massachusetts. Many prosecutors say state lawmakers are going too far with reforms, but some Senate leaders say action is needed now to reduce incarceration.
In Massachusetts, we are locking up four or five times as many people as we were 40 years ago.
Also, activist and writer Luang Ung remembers the killing fields of Cambodia and when the Khmer Rouge came to take her father.
One by one, he picked up my brothers and sister in his arms, and when it was my turn, I had the instinct of heart to wrap my arms around his neck and to rest my face next to his cheek, and just knowing that I would never see him again.
Her book is now a movie directed by Angelina Jolie. Plus, the still unresolved 30-year search for the New Bedford Highway serial killer. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Just days before the state Senate takes up a massive criminal justice reform bill, several Massachusetts prosecutors are rallying against parts of the measure. Nine of the state's 11 district attorneys have signed a six-page letter saying that the bill undermines the cause and pursuit of fair and equal justice for all. The letter, addressed to Senate President Stan Rosenberg and Senate Judiciary Committee Chair William Brownsberger, mentions some of the provisions in the bill that the DAs take issue with, including eliminating mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug crimes. The two DAs who did not sign the letter are Northwestern District Attorney David Sullivan and Middlesex County DA Marion Ryan, who happens to be president of the Massachusetts District Attorneys Association. Well, joining us is one of the prosecutors who did sign the letter, Suffolk County DA Dan Conley. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Deborah. Happy to be here.
Thanks for being with us. Also, we're joined by one of the addressees of the letter and sponsor of the criminal justice reform bill, State Senator William Brownsberger. He's chair of the Senate Joint Committee on the Judiciary. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Senator.
Delighted to be with you and delighted to be here with my friend Dan Conley.
And Dan, I just want to make sure that if you could tell folks, what are the prosecutors' main concerns about this legislation that's to be debated in the Senate Thursday?
Well, first of all, I should have said the same thing. I'm happy to be here with Will. He's been leading this effort in the Senate, and I have to say I have the greatest respect for him as a person and as a legislator. He's very smart, he's very thoughtful, and he's met with me at least a couple of times to talk about some of the ideas that ended up in this bill. I think one of the big concerns that the DAs have is that, first of all, it's a massive, you know, sprawling, complex piece of legislation. And, you know, I've been an attorney since 1983, and it took me a couple of good weeks to read it over and get even the understanding that I have of it now, and I think my colleagues, you know, feel the same way. You know, some of the ideas have been the subject of legislative committee hearings and so forth, but a number of the pieces of the bill presently before the Senate have not. It seems, frankly, to have been co-opted a bit or hijacked by some special interest and some really, ideas that we think are really quite dangerous.
Well, which one specifically? So are you saying it's too complicated to take up this many things in one piece of legislation?
I think that would probably, my advice would be, you know, that certainly I think most of the members of the Senate are not lawyers, to the best of my knowledge. I'm fairly quite sure if I had, you know, had to spend a good couple of weeks delving into this just to get the understanding level that I have right now, I'm sure they find themselves in the same predicament. But let me give you some of the things that should come as no surprise to Will.
I just wonder the examples of being co-opted or hijacked by special interests.
Oh, sure. I mean, decriminalizing sexual behavior between pre-adolescents, for example, that's been co-opted by somebody. I don't know who. I don't think most citizens of the Commonwealth think that sexual relations between, say, a 14-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl are ever appropriate. I mean, that's
a no, but hey, but hold on a second.
Two families that are in crisis.
Okay, Senator Brownsberger, I think, wants to address it and say, you know, why that's part of the legislation, that so-called Romeo and Juliet provision that would, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Senator, that would decriminalize consensual sex among some adolescents. Is that right?
People that are close in age. Basically, nobody's saying that's a good thing. I think it's a bad thing for kids to have underage sex, but that's up to the parents, the schools, the churches, the psychiatric social workers. It's not something that we really want to get jail involved with.
No one goes to jail. No 14-year-old boy is going to jail for having sexual relations with a 12-year-old girl. However, parents, police, teachers, community members, they turn to the district attorneys, and you know, there is absolutely no credible evidence that there's any issues around this. This is, as they say, the proverbial solution in search of a problem. And it's dangerous, really. I frankly can't believe that there's any honest broker out there who thinks that decriminalizing sexual relations between, say, an 18-year-old college freshman and a 15-year-old high school sophomore is good public policy.
Well, I think that's good. Yeah, I think that's one version here, and I think we can get down, and it's very controversial, of course, and I think we could spend the whole hour debating this. But
sure.
But let's talk about some of the other parts of the bill, because I think that's probably a very small part of the bill. Let's talk about some of the bigger issues, sort of mandatory minimum sentencing, which I think a lot of folks have talked about.
I mean, again, I said that this should come as no surprise to Will or no surprise, and I was very clear with him during my, you know, very respectful meetings, and I think most of the district attorneys have been as well, is that with, you know, with none of us, including, I don't believe, the two DAs that did not sign on, believe that we should have mandatory minimum sentencing for low-level, nonviolent drug users. And the good news is we don't. Our laws are aimed at traffickers, people who are moving significant amounts of drugs, and we believe that these have been very effective over the last 25 years in helping prosecutors and police and communities drive down violent crime. I mean, look, I was an assistant DA in 1984, and by the late 1980s, I was assigned to the Homicide Response Unit, and I was out every hour of the day and night during my shifts when I was assigned in 1990 and 91, responding to horrific acts of violence that largely revolved around trafficking and the distribution of drugs. And, you know, Will's predecessors established baseline under which, you know, certain individuals who violated those laws would be held accountable in a way that required the judges to sentence a defendant to a minimum period of incarceration. And it worked. I mean, here we have, in that era, upwards of 150 people who were murdered in our city of Boston. And today, I believe we're in the low 40s. That's 40 plus too many. But it's an incredibly safer city today, 25 years later, than it was then.
Because of mandatory sentences.
In part. That's one part of the toolkit of police and prosecutors.
Okay, I'd like to give Senator Brownsberger just a chance here to respond to some of your concerns and to say, you know, overall, what you're thinking about this letter, Senator.
Well, first of all, I just appreciate that DA has given it a close look, and there's a lot of knobs we can turn in this bill, and we'll keep working with them on all of them. But to the question of mandatory minimums, I agree with Dan on just about everything he said. There's a couple of distinctions I'd like to draw, though. But first, to agree, we all agree that there are no mandatories for nonviolent drug users. I also respect the work that law enforcement has done over the past many years to address the problem of violence, and we recognize that there is a relationship between that and drugs. And we all, in fact, favor a strong penalties on the books, mandatory minimum penalties, are willing to work with those mandatory minimum penalties for drug trafficking. And there's a statute, Chapter 32E, is the drug, Section 32E of Chapter 94C is the drug trafficking section. And we are not touching the heroin mandatory minimum trafficking penalties. In fact, we are strengthening them to include fentanyl and carfentanyl and all the other new, very poisonous, very dangerous drugs that are coming into circulation. We are lightening up a little bit on the cocaine mandatory minimums trafficking, But where we're putting our energy, and this is the important distinction, I want to distinguish between your traffickers and your low-level drug dealers. Not your low-level drug, not your users, but your low-level drug dealers, some of whom are also users, all of whom are kids that are that shouldn't be in, you know, that have gotten themselves into a bad business, but we want to turn them out of that business if we can. Jobs, if that's what they need, drug treatment, if that's what they need, rather than necessarily locking them up. So that's why we want to make that category of offense, what I would call the retail offense, the low-level drug dealer, as opposed to the wholesaler or the trafficker, not subject to mandatory minimum penalties, but something that the DA can work with the judge and sell them on sentencing the person to a lengthy sentence if that's what required, or perhaps to give more consideration to treatment if that's needed, or jobs or probation or whatever would be best.
So DA Conley, do you see that distinction there? You're saying we're not talking about major traffickers here. We're talking about low-level dealers who may be users, and certainly in the midst of an opioid crisis, judges are probably seeing a lot of this, and maybe there should be more judicial discretion in these cases.
Oh, I would say that all 11 district attorneys are very good and quite capable at distinguishing between low-level drug dealers who are dealing to support their own habits and those people that are actually trafficking and plying poison into neighborhoods and essentially wreaking havoc in those communities. Prosecutors, there have been prosecutors in the United States have been invested with discretion, and I would submit to you that the 11 prosecutors in Massachusetts, the district attorneys, exercised their discretion quite wisely. Every one of us, for example, has robust diversion programs. We have drug courts. We know and can pretty readily tell who needs to be incarcerated and who doesn't. You know, we hear a lot about being smart on crime. I would submit to you that the 11 DAs in Massachusetts have been and continue to be very smart on crime. Massachusetts remains only one of five states that has seen a decline in incarceration.
However, the rate, though, of incarceration since 1980 has gone up dramatically, as Senator Brownsberger has pointed out. And I just want to get to
that
because
again.
We only
what was that, Deborah? I'm not
that the rate of incarceration since 1980 in Massachusetts has increased dramatically, as it has in most states. We may have, I believe, a lower rate when compared with other states.
About 49th in the country.
Right, second lowest according to the Council on State Governments. Yes, that's relatively speaking, in an era of mass incarceration. However, incarceration has increased dramatically.
Massachusetts was never a participant in the problem of mass incarceration. That was a problem that existed in Texas and in Alabama and Arkansas. And what's problematic is that a number of legislators, and I'm not putting Will in this category, conflate problems that occur in other parts of the country, including the federal government, and overlay those issues onto Massachusetts. And I've tried to persuade many of them, perhaps unsuccessfully, that Massachusetts is a criminal justice leader. Can we do better? Yes, we can. All you have to do is look at our great football team, and they always say after a victory is we can always get better at this, and I agree with that philosophy. So we can agree on things like the elimination of all the onerous collateral consequences, which, by the way, none of the district attorneys ever endorsed or supported. These were ideas largely put onto the books by legislators over the years. Things like a bail. I'm very open to looking at the question of whether bail, as we know it today, should be reformed. There are too many people being held on $100 or $200 or $500 bail. I'm open to that. The Globe headline was that DAs harshly criticized the Senate. I would actually disagree with that. What we have been trying to do, look, these are hard conversations, but the DAs have wanted to act very constructively. But this requires candid conversations, and we remain very concerned with a number of discrete parts of this Senate bill that if they become law, this will be a big step backwards for our commonwealth.
I want to just make sure we get Senator Brownsberger in here. Senator Brownsberger, in terms of some of the things that District Attorney Conley has said, is Massachusetts already a leader and maybe doesn't need this level of reform? What do you say to that?
Well, I think, I'd be one that, here's how I look at it. Look, we have had within Massachusetts, comparing ourselves to ourselves, a huge increase in incarceration. Now, I'm not saying that's because we made a mistake. There's been a rise in crime. If you compare where we were in, let's say, 1960 to where we are now in terms of crime rates, we're higher now than we were. And so to have a higher crime incarceration rate maybe isn't a surprise, maybe isn't wrong. But here's where we are. We've gotten to a place where we have very high incarceration rates concentrated in neighborhoods of poverty and color. And that is a problem in itself. You know, moms and dads not around, kids without role models, a cycle of, you know, of people just keep turning around into the system. And that's what we've got to be concerned about. However we compare to other states, and Dan's absolutely right, we have a relatively low incarceration rate compared to other United States. By international standards, we're very high. By comparison to ourselves, very high. And in neighborhoods of poverty and color, very, very, very high in absolute terms. Yeah. And so that's what we have to be concerned about. That's why this is a bill about lifting people up instead of locking people up and cutting the chains that make it hard for people to get back up on their feet when they've been in trouble. And that's those collateral consequences where D.A. Conley and I are 100% on the same page.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but I want to, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about this some more as the Senate takes this up on Thursday. Senator William Brownsberger, a sponsor of the Criminal Justice Reform Bill. He's also co-chair of the Joint Committee on the Judiciary. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Suffolk County District Attorney Dan Connolly, he's one of the signers of the letters to Senate leaders regarding concerns about the criminal justice reform bill. Thank you very much, District Attorney Connolly.
Thank you, Deborah. Happy to be with you. Look forward to continuing the conversation with Will and his colleagues.
Okay, thank you. Housing costs in Boston usually cause complaints, and amid the improving economy and a contested mayoral race this year, those complaints appear to be getting even louder. Mayoral challenger City Councilor Tito Jackson says the price of housing is a huge issue.
I face people on a day-to-day basis. About 60 families who are coming to my office every single week who are getting pushed out. And by the way, looking at the courts, there are 5,000 evictions that happened last year.
Incumbent Mayor Marty Walsh says his administration has been working on this.
Since 2014, we have 22,000 units of housing that's been permitted in the city of Boston. Of those 22,000, 9,000 are moderate low-income units. What do I mean by that? People who are in between zero and, say, $120,000 per family, and which is the middle class.
But our next guest says, relatively speaking, housing costs in Boston aren't really that bad. Boston Globe Quick Study columnist Evan Horowitz is with us to talk about this. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Deborah. I can hear people are already upset.
Yeah. Can you hear them?
So, yeah, I can hear it.
So housing prices are going up, but still not as expensive as you might think. What does that mean, Evan?
Well, it means expensive compared to what? Right. Sure, housing prices are expensive compared to groceries. They eat up a lot of a family budget. They're often the biggest expense in a family budget. But that's not new. That goes back a long, long time. So the question is, expensive compared to other cities, expensive compared to what people earn. And the answers to these questions are rather different. It's sort of like, not really, or not as bad as we make it out to be.
Okay. I'm a native Buffalonian.
Well,
talk about housing in Buffalo and housing in Massachusetts. And
sure. I moved here from Dallas, where I had an enormous house at one-sixth the price. Wages are also a lot lower in Buffalo and in Dallas.
Right. Make us feel better. What's sort of a median home price in San Francisco right now? Most expensive area of the country.
Close to $1 million for a single family home, about $950,000. More than twice the cost of the median single family home in Greater Boston.
And here?
About half that.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about Greater Boston, right? So not just city center. But yeah, something around $425,000.
But aren't housing prices going up faster in Boston than in many other areas?
So yes and no. They have been rising over time, but they've been rising in every thriving city in the country over time. They're rising here faster in Seattle. They're rising faster in Portland. They're rising faster in Raleigh. Even places you think of as having cheaper housing, like Dallas, has seen housing prices go up just about as fast as they've gone up here, which surprises people because they're still relatively low. But no, the change in housing prices is a phenomenon of thriving cities everywhere. Mm. If you want housing prices to stop rising, you should move to a city that's failing. Yeah. There are some examples of those.
But also, I'm looking at some of the downsides here. I think there were studies that suggest that 40% of lower middle class neighborhoods in Greater Boston pay more for housing than their incomes can support. And also, Greater Boston loses a disproportionate number of low-income families when compared with cities like Los Angeles or New York. What does that mean for a community?
So I think this is a legitimate problem. And we have to again think compared to what? So two answers here. The first is, yeah, lower-income residents in Boston struggle to pay for housing. It's just that that's true everywhere. So it's not that things are good here. It's that there is no clear model of another city that's thriving and has found a way to house lower-income families. And the ways that exist to do it, like better vouchers, like rent control, are things that seem to be totally off the table in policy discussions at this point in time. The only answer people seem to champion is the sort of build, baby, build answer, which is, well, we'll just build more and more and more, and ultimately prices will come down. There's surprisingly little evidence that this actually works.
So what are cities doing anywhere? You know, you said there aren't any models, but are there some things that Boston might look to that other cities are doing that might try to keep things in check?
So tragically, I think the answer is no. I think there isn't a city out there that is thriving like Boston and has found a way to deal with this problem, which is one reason I mentioned rent control. This is an idea, rent control, a dead idea, right? This is an idea from years ago that cities abandoned in droves because it distorted house prices. But it may be an idea that we have to reconsider because nothing else seems to be working to help low-income families afford to stay in cities and maintain a diverse population. The other possibility is housing subsidies. We have a big federal housing subsidy program. Unfortunately, it's underfunded and way too small, unlike Social Security, or the programs that are considered guarantees for anybody who qualifies. There are millions of families who qualify for housing vouchers, but just end up on wait lists and don't get them.
Hmm. So when we do look at other cities, if we're not looking at the very high San Franciscos and the very low Buffaloes, what is Boston compared to and what are we talking about in terms of prices, both for housing and for rents?
So I think of peer cities as places like Seattle, Portland, D.C., Brooklyn. And these places tend to have roughly similar housing costs, relative to what people are earning, and they are all struggling with rapidly increasing housing costs that are making housing hard to afford for lower-income folks. And actually, on that measure, we tend to do better than almost all these cities.
Really?
That is, there are fewer lower-income folks struggling to afford housing here than there, which isn't to say there aren't a lot. There are a lot and probably too many. But Boston still looks relatively pretty good on that measure.
But we still don't know what to do about it. Finally, I want to...
I wish I had a different answer to that question, but I don't want to make something up.
Also, I want to talk about something else. You have a new piece out today about the age of members of Congress. Now, what made you write about this?
The fact that they're very old.
Okay, tell us how old they are.
So the average age of people in members of the Senate and the House has been rising in recent years dramatically. So the average age of members of the Senate is now roughly 62. So they could start collecting Social Security. In the House, it's more like 58. And what really sparked my interest here was a report a couple of weeks ago that a pharmacist in D.C. confessed to having provided members of Congress with Alzheimer's drugs. Now, couldn't say which ones because that would be a violation of professional ethics. But now there's this suggestion that not only is it an aging Congress, but it's an aging Congress with members who are struggling with potential cognitive impairment. And that struck me as a real potential public policy problem.
All kinds of late night jokes there. But what about how does this Congress compare the age compare with previous bodies?
So it's a lot older. We're about 10 years older on average than the trough, which is in the sort of Reagan years, or in the 78. End of the Carter era through Reagan, you have an average age in the around 50. Now we're around 60. And we're not the oldest Congress currently. Two sessions ago was a little bit older, but yeah, we're well above the historical norm.
And what do we know what that might do? I mean, some folks might say, hey, you know, with age comes wisdom, right?
I think that's a perfectly legitimate response to this. Mm. You could say, well, first of all, the country is aging, so it makes a certain amount of sense that Congress would be aging along with them. And yes, there's an experience argument to be made. However, I think there are two problems. One is the cognitive impairment problem because there are no checks on this. We don't do standard health assessments for members of Congress. We don't regularly check their cognitive abilities. There's nothing to ensure that people are operating at a reasonable capacity and not deteriorating. The other is perspective, salience issues. That is, the older you are, the more likely you are to care about issues that affect older people and not to be in touch with issues that affect younger people. So when the entire Congress is skewing older, you're more likely to have a focus on things like Social Security or maybe savings rates and less so on student debt, education, issues of greater salience to younger people.
All right. Boston Globe columnist Evan Horowitz joins us every other week. Thanks for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Next year will mark 30 years since the bodies of 9 women were found off highways near New Bedford, and police began suspecting a serial killer. But no one has ever been charged with those women's deaths. In the years since 1988, authorities have continued searching for 2 women who were reported missing around the same time but whose bodies were never found. All 11 women had troubled histories, some involving drug use or prostitution. Maureen Boyle was an investigative reporter in southeastern Massachusetts at that time, and she broke the story about the women's murders possibly being linked to a serial killer. She writes about this in her new book titled Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. Maureen Boyle, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So tell me first about some of the women here and some of the similarities. I know it's hard to generalize, but there were some, and that was what got people thinking. Right, that this might be a serial killer.
Yeah. All of the women had a similar height, weight. All of them disappeared from areas that were known drug areas or areas where women were known to be selling themselves.
Right.
And they all disappeared right around the same time, from the spring of 1988 to September of 1988.
Yeah. And so describe, you know, your book really lays out sort of how there was really one detective who said, you know, there's a link here. We're finding this. We're finding these bodies. We don't know what's going on. When did it become clear that this really might be the work of one person who was connecting all these women?
As you noted, there was one detective in New Bedford, Massachusetts, who began seeing a link in the number of women who were reported missing and the similarities in their disappearances. They began really classifying it unofficially as a serial killing case once the third body was found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was?
That was in November of 1988. The first body was found the 4th of July weekend of 88. The second body was found the end of July of 88. The third body was found in November of 88, and then another body was found.
And then they brought in the
dog. They brought in the dog after the third body, but they were planning on bringing in a dog prior to the third body coming in, more as a precautionary type of thing, after the New Bedford detective had approached the district attorney's office and suggested that the disappearances of, at that point, it was about 6 women that he knew of, might be linked, and possibly maybe linked to the 2 women that were found on the highway when he first approached the district attorney's office.
Mm-hmm. And there was, at one point, an indictment here.
Yeah, there was a New Bedford attorney who had a very troubled background, past, by the name of Kenneth Pond. He has since died. When he was much younger, he was a heroin addict. He recovered, got his college degree, went to law school, passed the bar. So at least on the surface, he was very, very successful. However, he then relapsed into drugs and was using cocaine. He knew all of the missing women. There was reports on the street that he was picking up girls on the street, not for sex, but asking them to buy drugs for him because he was embarrassed. He didn't want anyone to know that he was using again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So he had connections to a lot of these women, and he was found dead in his home in 2010. But 3 years before that, right, in 2007, investigators dug up his yard and said that they were looking for evidence that might be related to all of this. What was that all about?
Well, for years and years, there had always been rumors that he had killed the women and had buried one of the missing women in his yard underneath a cement patio. So once the house had been foreclosed, when the bank took it over, the district attorney at the time decided to come in with the bank's permission and dig up the yard. But no bodies were found.
And there was another suspect at one point, right? Tony DeGrazia.
There was actually quite a number of suspects. But Tony DeGrazia was a man in his 20s who had a very sad past. He had told police and had told doctors that he had been abused as a child quite severely. He was known to pick up the girls on the street and go for their neck and start choking them.
And he's also deceased as of 1991. So really, though, it's sort of amazing that this could have gone on and no one held responsible. Is that, do you think a function of maybe not having the tools that we have today to be able to solve these kinds of crimes? Because when you read some of the ways, you're thinking paper, there were no fingerprints. Like, what's going on? There are no computers. Like, you forget, right?
Yes.
That those things really could have hampered an investigation. Yeah. I mean, is that a big issue, do you think?
Yep. That's a very good question. And that's so true. Back then, not that many people had cell phones. Most of us did not. There were some members in law enforcement who did, but not many. Most of them, if they had anything, they had the Nextel, and those were mostly the narcotics officers. Many of the police departments did not have their fingerprints digitized. They were not into a database. Only a few of the departments in the state had their fingerprints in the statewide database. So even identifying someone was very, very difficult. And for DNA samples, he needed very large samples to test at that time. And sometimes the samples were destroyed in the testing process themselves.
So do you think the person responsible will ever be found? Is anyone any closer today?
I hope that the person will be found or identified. Even after 30 years, and that's why it took me so long to write the book, because I kept on waiting for that ending, for someone to be caught so I could say, yes, there is a conclusion to the case. So I still have hope. And I know that the families still have hope. Sometimes they're disappointed. There are a few family members that have given up hope, but someone cannot get away with murder. Especially the murder, most likely, of 11 women.
Right, right. But even though someone wasn't caught, you wrote the book anyway. So you were waiting for this to happen.
It didn't happen,
but you wrote the book anyway.
Yes.
So why do it now? What are you hoping? Are you hoping that maybe more leads will come forward because maybe there will be more interest generated in this case again?
Yes, I hope so. I hope there will be more interest. And with time, sometimes time is on the side of an investigation. As people get older, they may not be with the same individual that they were with before. Their lifestyles change. They have children of their own. Mm-hmm. And they may have evidence that they feel this is the right time.
Mm-hmm. Is the case considered open at this point?
Yeah, the case is always open. All murder cases are officially open. But it's not a case that the detectives are working on every single day because there isn't anything to follow up on. When they do have things to follow up on, they do. I know in the past, they have repeatedly sent down evidence to different labs, particularly the FBI lab, for retesting, as there's been some forensic technological advances.
Any theories you have that you would share?
I think I have had so many theories over the years that it drives people that I know crazy. As I said, this is a person, that is a person. Several of the working theories that they had at the time was, number one, that it was a fisherman who came from the South. And then he went back down south. Two, that it was a trucker. Three, that it was someone who wound up in prison. And that's why the killing stopped. Mm-hmm. Because as far as we know, the disappearances ended in September of 1988. The other theory is that the individual moved on. And he's operating someplace else in the country. That the killer may be dead. Mm-hmm. That the killer may have contracted AIDS. And this was his revenge. That this was a relative of someone who died of AIDS. And they're exacting revenge on women on the street.
A lot of theories.
And for each of, or that it was a sex offender who was on furlough from the Center for the Sexually Dangerous. At that time, sex offenders were let out on furlough for days at a time with little or no supervision.
Mm-hmm. Right. So not really any closer. But what about, you mentioned briefly that some of the families had given up hope, and we don't have too much time here left. But overall, would you say that they are still hopeful that there may be some type of information?
That's a good question. They all are very, very hopeful. Because it really is an open wound for the relatives, particularly the children, who they've lost their mother, they now have families of their own, but there is still that hole in their heart to this day, that one, their mother is dead; two, the killer has never been identified, and I say identified because even if he's dead, we deserve to know who the person is.
Okay. Maureen Boyle leads the journalism program at Stonehill College. Her book is titled Shallow Graves, The Hunt for the New Bedford Highway Serial Killer. She'll be speaking about it next Thursday, November 2nd, at the Boston Public Library. You can find information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Maureen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Our next guest is a survivor. In 1975, Luang Ung was just 5 years old, living with her family in the Cambodian capital Phnom Penh, where her dad worked in the government. That year, the communist Khmer Rouge regime came to power. The regime emptied the capital, putting families like Ung's into labor camps, where they were forced to work the fields and were beaten, tortured, some of them starved. The Khmer Rouge killed almost 2 million Cambodians, including Ung's parents, two of her sisters, and 20 other relatives. But Ung and four of her siblings managed to escape. She eventually made her way to Vermont as a refugee, and she wrote about her experiences in her 2000 memoir titled First They Killed My Father. Now, together with actress and director Angelina Jolie, they've turned her powerful story into a new Netflix original film of that same title. Ung is an activist and best-selling author, and she's in town to speak at Rosie's Place. She joins us in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
So what was it like for you to work on this project and to bring back those emotions and experiences from when you were such a little girl and things were so traumatic?
I went into it very fearful. I was very afraid that was going to relive the trauma, that it was going to be very, very difficult to stand still and be in that space. So I actually started working out. I wanted to be strong. I wanted to be physically strong because I felt so powerless during the war. And the four, almost 5 months I was in Cambodia working on the film, and I was on the set pretty much every day, the question of strength wasn't an issue. For me, it was the scenes of beauty, of tenderness, of joy, of family, of just the very first scene of my family sitting together, mm-hmm. all nine of us around a table having dinner, while the mother served my character food and the father's drinking wine. And those scenes were so much more difficult because you can't prepare yourself for the missing. It is very hard to see that because you realize how much you missed and how much you wish they were still there, and how much beauty still exists, and it exists during those times, and how much I missed that. Mm. And so for me, those were much harder to do and much more heartbreaking. Mm. But it was also redemptive and spiritual because in that one scene, I almost felt as if my family came back to life. as if for that moment, in that scene, in that space, we were together again, sitting around a dinner table and just being a part of a family.
You were so young when that happened, and it was remarkable to watch the film and to see the young actress who plays you in the film sort of express a lot of the emotions that must have been going on, the confusion and uncertainty about why you were going and where you were going. What were you thinking at the time? Do you remember?
I was young, too young to understand the politics. I was too young to understand the mechanics and the policies of the Khmer Rouge. But I understood very well my parents' love. I understood very well the expressions on my father's faces when he couldn't protect us. I understood very well my mother's tears when my father was taken from us and then she had to send us away. And so for me, I think as a child growing up in Cambodia, you live very much in your body. And so you are, as an adult, I think sometimes I have a tendency as a writer also to float off in your head and in your mind. And if you're in a situation that's difficult, uncomfortable, traumatic, you can just escape your head, escape your mind. But when you're surviving in a genocide, in a war, in a trauma, you cannot escape your head. You have to be there. You can't leave your mind because you need your mind in order to take care of your body and to protect yourself. Otherwise, you die. Right. And so I was very, very aware of trying to be conscious and trying to be aware and trying to be observant and trying to really just look around my environments. And this is probably the reason I was able to capture so much of my life onto pages, into my diary, onto the pages, because I had to really pay attention in order to live.
Hmm. Yeah, I always had to be on the lookout for how you might be hurt, how you might get out of a difficult situation. That's an amazing skill, though, to learn at the age of 5. And what does that do to your psyche?
Yes, I it's my belief that a writer writes and a published writer gets his or her work published for various reasons. And so I think genetically and DNA-wise, I've always been a very observant person. I'm very curious about the world. I love looking and watching and learning and studying. And so that helped me be able to be aware of my surrounding to survive. But it also meant that the memories were imprinted in such a way into my brain that even had I wanted to forget them, I couldn't. And therefore, the memories came back, whether it's in my memories or in the loud explosions of every 4th of July fireworks, or whether it is in the hums of a mother's song as I walk by a park, or the laughter of a father playing with his or her son or daughter, that are always often bring me back and triggering war memories.
Right. We actually have a clip from the movie here. This is the moment when two soldiers come for your father, two Khmer Rouge soldiers come, and they tell him that they need his help. And here is the scene where he is walking away with him, and the actress who plays you in the movie is calling out. Let's listen. It was such an incredible scene in the movie. That must have been incredibly difficult for you to help with, right?
Yes, it was difficult to help with. It was difficult to remember. It was difficult to write about, and it's difficult now to hear it. I'm emotional again, and I'm trying not to, trying not to just completely break. And every time I hear it, I'm brought back to that place. Thankfully, we shot the film surrounded by so much love, so much humanity, so much care, and we're led by a wonderful director, Angelina Jolie, and wonderful producer, Rithi Pan, and surrounded by so much care. Everybody who worked on the movie were themselves either survivors or children of survivors. And so I knew that this wasn't just my story. It was a story of Cambodia. It was a story of many of us. And in many ways, it's also a story of the world. It didn't just happen to Cambodia, this crime against humanity, genocide and war crimes. This hurt all of us. I'm just very grateful to be part of a wonderful collaboration in telling the story on film.
Hmm. You know, tell us about your mother, too, because I know the movie is certainly titled after, taking your father. But your mother, really, her strength in this movie and what she did to make sure that her children could survive is really amazing.
Yeah. And that's why I was so grateful and happy to be at Rosie's place today. I was there giving a talk at an annual fundraising event. Because my mother had a strength and a courage about her that I did not understand, recognize, value, or even saw growing up during the war. All I saw during the war when the soldiers came for my father was her pain. I saw her heartbreaks. I saw her pain. I saw her suffering. And that was so traumatic that I got to a place as an adult where I kind of forgot about her beauty. I forgot about her strength. And it wasn't until I was working for 3 years at a domestic violence shelter in Maine where I saw the courage and beauty of a mother, a mother's heart, a mother's strength, a mother's courage, and whatever a mother had to do to keep her children safe. And I'm so grateful to be able to see that as an adult because my mother was the bravest and strongest woman I will ever know. I didn't know this as a child. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't fathom it. But could you imagine having to send off your young children into the war zone not knowing if they would live or be killed or hurt or tortured or if you would ever see them again, but knowing that you had to do it because if you don't and the soldiers came for you, they would take all of you together. Mm. And so in order to give us a fighting chance to live, she separated all of us and pushed us out and away from her.
Right. That's just incredible. You were sent at one point to a camp where you were to be trained as a child soldier, and that involved doing work such as planting landmines, which you eventually realized in the movie were what they were. You didn't even understand when you were doing it, and that's become part of your life's work, hasn't it? Sort of trying to eliminate landmines. Is that a way, do you think, that you try to make amends for that?
I have always wanted to redeem myself. Mm. And understanding that my survival in some way, I feel a lot of guilt for it, what I did, how I survived, and writing, working to ban landmines, working to end violence against women, even just my attempts and my daily consciousness to be a better person, to be a kind, decent human being. No matter what happened in my life, where I go, what I do, I am very aware that I want to be a decent human being. Mm-hmm. I want to be somebody who cares. I want to be someone who takes actions. I want to be someone who is constantly aware that we do have power to make a difference. But in order to make a difference, we have to act. And so whatever in our capacity or abilities as human beings, and for me, it's writing and working on landmines campaign. But for others, it's being a student, being a journalist, being a writer, being a mother, being a good friend, being a chef, being a cook, being somebody who makes beer, whatever it is in our lives that we can do to make a difference. It is our obligations and a responsibility to do it.
Hmm. You know, this is a story of, you know, a lot of different things. The resilience of a young child, which is just remarkable, and your resilience. And also, you know, a film about, you know, using the story of war really to tell a story of love, right? Where did the resilience and that positive attitude, how does it come out of all that tragedy?
I'm so grateful, again, to be a woman living to be at this age in life, so I've learned a lot. I remember when Pol Pot died in 1998, in his last interview, he talked a lot about what he did for love. And I wanted to negate that. I wanted to write a different story of love, that love does not a genocide make, that love does not kill close to 2 million people out of a population of 7 million people, that love, real love, consists of compassion and humanity and gentleness. And I wanted to write the story of love that takes place in the midst of war in order to honor my parents. And I think for me, my resilience have been my ability to realize that I didn't get here alone, that wherever I fell, however much hard I fall, there have been always somebody, past, present, in my mind, in my heart, in our community, who have been there to help give me that helping hand to stand up. And I've been grateful for that. And those are the stories of love that I want to tell.
Wang Young is author, activist, and co-writer of the film First They Killed My Father. She did the film with Angelina Jolie, and it's now streaming on Netflix. Wang, thanks so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.